History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do something about it. And of course, our goal is always to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to then try to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we find that not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. Each story is unique, and the Silver Star recipient we're going to hear from today lied about his age to enter the military at just 15. Bob McCoy is 91 now and lives in Fairfield, California, surrounded by quite a few fellow military retirees at Paradise Valley Estates. But he grew up in a different part of the country. Bob, what can you tell us about your hometown of Colton, South Dakota? What kind of place is that?
A town of about 1,700 people, and we lived 3.5 miles outside of town on a farm. And my mother was born there. Her parents were both 100% Norwegian. They came over, and they got gifted 160 acres by living there and making some progress on it. And so it was a quarter of a section of a land. And that's where my mother was born, and that's where I was born.
What do you remember about those childhood years? I imagine life was a little different than what kids experience in Fairfield, California today.
I don't remember a hell of a lot about it. We lived on a farm, and I can remember a tornado come through, and we all went to a cellar where we kept this stuff in the wintertime or in the summertime to keep it cool, because we didn't have any electricity or any running water or anything. Tornado came through, and we could hear the horses screaming, and we lost two lambs, our favorite little lamb. It took the roof off our barn and put it out in the field, and I used to drag my wagon out there because the roof was still fairly intact, and I'd drag my wagon out, and I'd drag it up on top, and I'd come down and ride that wagon down over the shingles. I can remember that. I was probably about 5 or 6 years old, 7. During that period.
And I imagine those winters get pretty cold and windy there.
Oh, I was born in December 1932 in one of the worst storms for that year, evidently. No doctor, no phone, no heat, no electricity, of course. And my mother's sister came there to visit, my Aunt Louise, and she was the one that delivered me because they couldn't get a doctor or anything there. So. I was delivered by my mother's sister, Aunt Louise. My mother died when I was about 6, maybe 6.5. I was stationed up in Alaska when my Aunt Louise died, and I came home on emergency leave for her funeral.
What happened to your mother to die so young?
She was 39. She was having birth. She died of the birthing. I guess. I really don't know.
Do you remember, as a boy, having some thoughts of, hey, when I grow up, here's who I'm going to be or what I'm going to do?
No, but I remember watching the airplane come by and say, I want to fly someday. But that was a few years later. We had moved to a new location, a little farther north, I think it was. I used to remember, I would go out and crawl up on a straw sack on a Wednesday night so I could probably see the airplane a little earlier than I could down at the ground level. And I would watch it. Sometimes you could hear it first and then you'd find it. It was kind of interesting. It was a DC-3.
Well, and I'm curious, too, because you mentioned, you know, you had a brother that was much older who actually served in World War II, survived the Battle of the Bulge. You know, being at home and having a brother overseas that you didn't know if he was going to make it back or not, was that something that weighed on you?
No, I didn't know much too much about that, really. I had two older sisters also between my brother and I. They both got married. It was just my dad and I, and I was about 13, 14 years old, and that's the reason I kind of signed for me when I was 15. I filled out the paperwork and said I was 17, and he signed it, and off I went.
And I've interviewed a few guys like you. In fact, you have your own organization of underage military veterans who were so motivated to serve that you lied about your age. What was the motivation for you at 15 years old to twist your dad's arm?
I tried at 14, but they said wait till December 5th so you'd be 17 or so that your dad could sign for you. I had to lie. It was just my dad and I, and we would go by for my evening meal was a ring of bologna and a box of crackers, and he'd be drinking a beer at the little service station. And that would be our evening meal. And he'd give me a couple rings of bologna and a couple of crackers. And I could sip his beer, though.
So for you, getting into the military meant a better life.
Oh, yes. It was truly a dream come true. Mm. When the train left Sioux Falls heading for Chicago to Fort Sheridan, Illinois, it was 3 days after Christmas, the 27th or 28th of December 1947. I get to Chicago. As soon as the train left Sioux Falls, it was over 43 miles from where I was born, so as far away from home as I'd ever been.
And you ended up seeing a fair amount of the world in your Air Force career, huh?
Yes, I did.
I haven't seen any pictures of you at 15, but I have to imagine some people knew you had a little bit of a baby face, and you probably weren't prepared for some of the things you dealt with.
Right out there, there's a picture of me at age 18, I think.
What was it like for a 15-year-old in the military? Are there some moments that you look back on and that was kind of a rude awakening or a welcome to this new life?
Well, when I first started out in Fairbanks, Alaska, they said, do you want an inside job? I said, well, yes, I do. So they made me an 055, which is a file clerk. But I didn't know anything about filing. But I didn't need to because I was the general's janitor. My first 2 years, I was a general's janitor, and I had a little cubby hole with a sink and my brooms and mops on the wall and the buffer sitting over here, and I had a nice easy chair, and I could study for my high school equivalency test. That's what I ended up doing. Mm-hmm. So I got my GED test done. That's the reason. And then the Korean War broke out, and they lowered the requirements for getting into pilot training from 2 years of college to a high school equivalency or high school education, and I got my from Wisconsin or whatever the place that Air Force had my equivalency, and I managed to get into the aviation cadets.
What did it feel like to finally have a chance to fly, to be at the controls in the air?
I tell you, it was a beautiful thought. My dream came true.
Do you remember the first plane you went up in?
Oh yes, yeah. I got my pilot's license up in Fairbanks, Alaska, but it was just a little cub for my first plane. I took my private pilot's license in Luscom, and I did it 31 March 1950. I just turned 17 in December, and you had to be 17 before you could get your private pilot's license, so I did that.
So as a civilian, you were 17, but in the Air Force, you were 19.
No, I told them about my age when I was in, and I got redlined from basic training. I had to get my father's death certificate, my mother's death certificate, my dad's signature, saying he would never mind me being service anywhere in the world. There was four of us that got redlined, and I was the only one that got to stay in the service. I don't know why, other than there was signed by a Benjamin R. McCoy, Major General, head of Air Force personnel. No relation whatsoever, but I didn't know that until 8 years after I'd been... My wife and I visited a place on the East Coast there, and I got to see my records. And there was that letter. But I found out that it was my approval was signed by Major General McCoy. It explains what this captain that I was whitewashing all the rocks waiting for my assignment was treating me. I didn't have to whitewash another rock when he got that letter. I was approved for retention in the service.
What a journey. And, you know, I'm thinking back to... You're sharing that your first job in the Air Force was the general's janitor in Fairbanks, Alaska. Did you ever mention to that general that you wanted to be a pilot or that's what you were going to do someday?
I don't think I ever talked to him. Mm-hmm. I talked to his secretary only. I think his name was Gail Gaffney, was his name. Mm-hmm. I haven't really checked that out, but I remember that just all of a sudden now it came to me.
Since that first time in the air, how many hours as a pilot have you put in?
Oh, I got a record of about 26,750 hours on record, but I probably have a few more hours than that because I flew my own airplane quite a bit, and I didn't really log all the hours I've got in it.
And can you give us a taste of the array of different aircraft that you've been in the cockpit of?
In the civilian or military. We started out with a little Super Cub for primary pilot training, and then basic, and we went to the T-6 at Bainbridge, Georgia. And then I went to Laredo, Texas for final pilot training, and I flew the T-28 and the T-33. And then I graduated in the top 5% of my class, so we could supposedly go get our first assignments. And so I put in for F-86s, and I should have had it, but they said, nope, we're going to take it. The top 10% is all going to go to the instructor school. So I ended up going to an instructor school. And then while I was there, they were opening up a course for senior officers because the Air Force was turning to a jet Air Force, but all the senior officers had no jet time. So we started a school at Shepherd Air Force Base in Texas. There's 12 second lieutenants and 2 first lieutenants and a captain. And we started a school, and we started getting 12 students every 2 weeks. And my first 2 were full colonels, and then I ended up with a major general. And he brought his VB-17 up there and had it parked on the ramp, and I gave him his first dollar ride, as we call it, free ride, you know, type thing, because we had a little 8-ball there, and if they forgot something, they had to put 50 to a nick quarter or 50 cents in it, and then we used it for a party at the end of their thing. He says, okay, you showed me what you've been flying there, Lieutenant, now get in the left seat of this one. So his IP, he had to fly with an IP in the B-17, was in class with him, and his name was Captain Gray. But when I finished with him, he was Captain White.
I'm not the first person you've used that line on, I know. So I'm just thinking about this. The irony of the guy who, a couple years earlier, is the general's janitor, is now teaching generals and colonels who've flown all this time in combat how to fly these planes that they didn't know how to fly.
Well, that's true.
Pretty wild.
Yeah, it was a nice job. I really enjoyed I spent almost 3 years there instructing. Then I managed to get out of there to the F-86 training at Williams, Arizona. And from there, I went up to F-100s in Nellis. And then I went over to Clark Air Base in the Philippines to a F-100 squadron. And we stood nuclear alert up on Tainan Island, Formosa. We were standing nuclear alert, and I was combat ready, except I didn't know how to play bridge. So before they put me on alert, to stand nuclear alert, I had to learn how to play bridge.
Seems like an odd requirement.
Yeah, it was.
And explain to the layperson what that means practically when you're on nuclear alert. What's the significance?
You're sitting there, there's a foursome, and your airplanes are all ready to go. And when the buzzer goes off, you got 7 or 8 minutes to get airborne. We were going to go bomb with a nuclear weapon on board.
So you're standing by to help end the world.
Well, fight for our cause.
I mean, I say it that way. That seems like a heavy responsibility on your shoulders.
Well, it was, but you stood in a nuclear alert. You had your target. Sometimes you had to refuel first, meet your tanker and refuel, and then hit on in.
So there were times you were airborne with a nuclear weapon?
No, you never got airborne. The runway was always blocked. Okay. And anytime we had a snow, there was always a red light out there, a car on the runway blocking anybody from taking off. But thank God they didn't ever leave the runway open for us to take off. That meant that we were on our way.
It's just a reminder, you know, that of all the things that happened, there are things that didn't happen that would be really significant.
And that brings to mind a question that I'm going to ask Bob when we come back. If you'd like to see what this decorated fighter pilot looked like then, or what he looks like now, you can head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing.
growing.
Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 91-year-old Bob McCoy of Fairfield, California, originally from Colton, South Dakota. He lied about his age with his father's help and enlisted in the Air Force at age 15. Starting out as a general's janitor in Alaska, he eventually became a fighter pilot, and when we left off, Bob had mentioned standing nuclear alerts, prepared to take off with a nuclear payload to potentially bomb the USSR. And I mentioned that that brought to mind a question. Do you have an opinion or a perspective now on how close we came during those Cold War years to having something like that happen?
Not so much overseas with the nuclear weapon, but we were going to bomb Cuba. And I was standing alert with a load of bombs to go bomb a runway on the south side of Cuba. And we were ready to go, running, and the wing commander had his red light on his vehicle blocking the runway, and they canceled it out. So that was we were close to doing that. We were really close to doing that.
And is there something, is there a mental exercise that you go through to process how to execute those kind of orders?
Not really. Yeah. That's what you're trained to do. Mm-hmm. I was prepared to do it.
And I don't want to leave out, you know, anything important, but you go from the F-100s during this Cold War period to flying the F-105s in Vietnam. How long did you spend over there?
I went to the 105 in 1960 in Seymour Johnson, North Carolina. And then after flying it there, I got assigned to Gadina, Okinawa, to the 67th Stack Fighter Squadron. My squadron commander was Robinson Reisner, Robbie Reisner, who was an ace in Korea, flying F-86s. He was my squadron commander. He was a wonderful man.
I've seen his statue at the Air Force Academy. And years ago, I went to church with his brother, but I never had the opportunity to know him. And he famously ended up being a prisoner of war for quite some time, did he not?
He got shot down the first time in April of 1965, and he got recovered and he managed to get out over the water, and he bailed out, and he got picked up. And then on 16 September 1965, there were six of us. I was number five, leading a flight of two, and I had the only target that was known. It was a SAM site in North Vietnam. He was, and the other four people were, we all went to the tanker together. And after I refueled, my wingman and I, we went to the north and descended, and we lost radio contact with them while we hit our target. And when we got in radio contact with them on our way out, Riley Reiser had been shot down, the ops officer, Reba Barrett, had been shot down, and the two wingmen had joined up. And so I had battle damage on mine because I got hit three times. I went out and refueled and came back in and relieved the two boys, the wingmen, so they could go home. And that's when I got my Silver Star. I was trying to get the rescue people in because I had his chute. I could home in on his chute signal. He said, "I was so happy when you finally got out of there." He says, "Every time you came by, flew over, they shoved my face deeper in the mud."
Well, obviously, there's a lot more to explore with this story. But I guess maybe to give people perspective, we should explain what the nature of your missions were and the purpose of that aircraft, the F-105. Can you help us understand kind of the operational purpose that you guys were performing?
Well, we were not operating with any forward air controller. No, we just had our targets, and we refueled, and then we headed north, and there were certain places. It's usually better to approach your target at low altitude if you could, because otherwise you'd fire more SAMs missiles at you if you were at a higher altitude. So you had to come in, and then you'd find your target, you'd pitch up to 12, 14,000 feet and roll back in order to hit your target.
What are some of the typical hazards, obstacles, dangers that you might encounter on a mission like that?
ACAC, SAM missiles, and also some of the MiGs would be available if they had time to get there.
So I'm asking you what might seem like some elementary questions for you, so our listeners understand. This was a pretty dangerous duty that you were carrying out.
Oh, yeah. We lost 485 F-105s over North Vietnam, maybe a little bit more than that. And then they lost a bunch of F-4s later on. But initially, it was the 105s that was doing the bombing of North Vietnam.
And how did you feel about all that, about the different things that, let's be real, could end your life or make you a prisoner?
That's true, because you just had to live with the thought. But we always came back to a clean sheets at night. At least we were doing it out of Krat, Thailand. And then also another base was Tak Lee, Thailand. They had 105s there also.
And some people have maybe heard that moniker for the F-105, the Thud. Can you explain where that nickname came from?
The Thud. Well, when I hit the ground, it went thud. I am a Thud pilot. I love my plane. It is my body. I am its brain. My Thunder Chief loves me, and I love her too, but she picks up flack like a magnet can do. If I get my 100 and I'm still alive, I'll say with relief, goodbye, Thunder Chief, my F-105.
Every F-105 pilot memorized that one?
Oh, I think probably so, yes.
This mission in question that you received the Silver Star for. You go in, bomb the targets, and two of these planes are shot down, and you said your plane was hit as well. Did you have any idea what extent the damage was?
I came back, my wingman told me, he said, Lee, you got three hits in your right-hand stabilizer, and we were hitting at low altitude, so where the bullet had ended from the rear till it came out the front was about 27 or 28 inches. And it went through the spar, the inner star on that right end. And so he says, I would pull too many G's if I were you, because you'd probably lose that part. Mm-hmm. And so, but it was flying okay. And so I didn't do a pitch out when I came back and landed, though. I pulled your G's as you go around the corner. I made a straight in approach and a landing.
You mentioned Robbie Reisner. By this time, you had gotten to know him pretty well. What kind of guy was he?
Oh, he was a non-alcoholic. He wouldn't drink any alcohol whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And we were deployed down to Hawaii, putting on a firepower demonstration there between one of our missions down at the Karat. We were just going TDY down there from getting to Okinawa. And we were at Don Ho's one night. And it was a big, you heard of Don Ho, you know, the big... Yeah. And we had a big table for about eight of us sitting around it. And they came around and I said, okay, everybody get ready to do a toast for your table. And he said, old Robert looked at her and he says, McCoy, you got one available on the way, he thought of me. I said, I'll think of something. And they had an applause meter. And they'd come around and people would give their toast for their table and applause. And so they came to my table and I stood up and I had my drink away in my hand. I said, friends may come, and friends may go, and friends may peter out, you know, but I'm your friend through thick or thin.
And since I know we often have younger listeners for whom the rest of that toast might not be appropriate, we're going to cut that off right there. But in that crowd that night, I guess it went over pretty well.
We won. The applause meter pegged out. And we wanted all the drinks at our table.
And so that day, when this happens, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes and understand all the implications. So two of your guys have been shot down, and you know that they're down there somewhere, but you don't know what's happened to them.
We didn't have voice contact with them, but I could still home in on the signal that their chutes, one of their chutes was putting out. It automatically activates itself when your chute opens, and you can home in on it, put your thing on EDF, and it'll point at the thing where your sound is coming from, and then when it swing around, you just pass over it. So that's where he said, every time you came by there, he said, they just shoved my face deeper in the mud. I was so happy when you left.
But for you, you're thinking, if I can pinpoint where he is, I can get a helicopter to come and rescue him?
If you can get voice contact with the down person, yeah. And he'd always throw his radio away.
But for you, not knowing that, you don't want to leave because you know it may be his life.
Yeah, that's true.
You're hanging on as long as you can, hoping to help save him.
We got the helicopters and the people operating the helicopters. They're in another big airplane to control it. They're close by. South Vietnam is not too wide down here. Mm-hmm. And so they were close by. And if we could have got voice contact, you know, they would have been right there within 15 or 20 minutes. But we couldn't get any voice contact with them because they'd been picked up already, rescued, captured.
But you were awarded the Silver Star because you were risking your own life to try to save theirs.
I came in and relieved his wingman with a battle-damaged airplane. I logged an extra mission that day. Because I came out and I went back in.
Yeah, I guess I have to ask you why. Why did you want to do that?
I wanted to rescue him because nobody had made the decision yet whether he could possibly be rescued or not. So it was worth a try.
But you had a damaged plane and the other guys didn't, and you told them to go home so you could stick your own neck out.
Yeah, that's true. But I came back and hit the tanker, and then I came back in. They hadn't had a chance to get their tanker yet, so I was relieving them, trying to operate the rescue people. So I took over that, unsuccessful.
And I asked this because I can tell you had a respect and esteem for Reisner and thought highly of him. How long was it till you learned that he was actually alive?
Goodness, it was quite a while before they got word to his wife that he was alive. His picture was on the front of a Time magazine, you know, after his first bailout. And they had the picture of him in Hanoi. So they let it be known that he was there. So it wasn't that long. It was a couple of weeks, I think.
Because he had been well known for finding his way out before, and now they got this famous guy.
Yep.
And when you say that he told you every time you flew over, they stuck his face in the mud, we're reading between the lines, you two connected later on.
Oh, we got together in Las Vegas for the big reunion in April of 83.
And I'm just curious what that was like, because here, you know, I'm sure there had been part of you that always wondered what happened to him, what he went through, and all that, and now you two are back together. Can you take us back there, what that reunion was like and what kinds of things he shared with you?
He came out here to California and he visited me, and I gave him a ride in my airplane over from Napa. He was doing a speech at Napa, and so we went down there and I got on the front row. He looked down there and he said, "Get up here, McCoy." It was pretty good. But then I flew him over to his next place over North California, and I said, "You notice I didn't let you fly my airplane." He said, "Why not?" I said, "I've seen you get ready too damn many airplanes." I was joking with him.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of funny. The other guy was named Ron Byrne. He was my flight commander. Mm-hmm. And he was going back to Gdynia for his daughter's graduation or some darn thing. He was gone for a couple, 3 days, 4 or 5 days. And I got two missions ahead of him. And then I was standing this mission. We got canceled out for 2 days, and then he finally came back and he seen that I got two missions ahead of him. He scratched my name off, and he took my place. He was my flight commander, I guess. And he got shot down. He spent over seven and a half years as a POW. So when I seen him at the reunion, I said, Robert, I never did get a chance to thank you for scratching me off that mission. He says, McCoy, he says, for 2,729 days, I thought about you every damn day. He was there 7.5 years.
I'm sure it's probably good for everybody to have a laugh about it, but there's some reality to it, too. How, I mean, is there part of you that when, you know, Reisner's a POW, when Byrne is a POW, that you think about, hey, that could have been me?
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, when I first hired, got into the 67th Squadron, there was 28 pilots. At the end of the Vietnam War, 14, exactly 50%, had been shot down over North Vietnam, 50%. 9 of them were POWs, 4 were rescued, that's 13, and 2 got killed when it went into the airplane. So exactly 50% of our squadron got shot down.
That really underscores the sobering reality of the assignment Bob McCoy and his fellow pilots of the 67th Fighter Squadron had in Vietnam. I'm going to try to glean a little more info about his close calls when we come back. 91-year-old Bob McCoy of Fairfield, California is our guest today, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-530-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a fascinating and colorful visit with 91-year-old retired fighter pilot Bob McCoy of Fairfield, California. He told us about the mission that earned him the Silver Star. And you said, Bob, on that mission, your F-105 Thunder Chief took 3 hits.
I'm sure that wasn't the only time your plane got shot up a little bit or you had a close call. Are there some other memories that stand out?
On my 71 missions, I had some battle damage on 17 missions. I came home with battle damage.
What were some of the most significant examples of that?
Our Bombay tank held 390 gallons, I think it was. But I took a hit in my Bombay tank, and it was our good get-home fuel. Really, you know, once you left Vietnam, if you had 3,000 pounds, you could make it to Karat. But with my $2,900 or 2,900 pounds in my Bombay tank, the bullet went in and did not explode. It just left a big hole and started draining my tank really slow. And you put pressure on it to feed it to your other parts of the airplane, and it was really shooting out, you know. The guy said, you're leaking your fuel, you know. So I didn't dare use my afterburner because it was all would have really been a big fire back there. I ended up having to land at Budorn, which is in northern Thailand.
Are there any of those 71 missions that when you think back on them, you say, boy, I'm kind of surprised I made it through that one?
Anytime I flew on Reiser's wing, I was happy to get home because he always found something to fire at. We started having some MiGs and we started carrying the outboard, the air-to-air missiles, the heat-seeking missiles. And so I'm on his wing one day and we fired at some fuel tanks. So we had a small fire going by one of them. He says, let's save our missiles at that and see if we can take the whole thing out. He never liked to bring home any ammo. Robbie Reiser, if he had any 20 millimeter left, he would expend it somewhere.
So he liked to take chances.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He knew that if he could start a bigger fire, it would be better. He came home. He made Brigadier General. He lived for quite a few more years, but he's since been gone at least 5 years, I guess.
You can link to more info about the late General Robbie Reisner at hometownheroesradio.com. But you mentioned a moment ago MiGs.
How often or how frequently did you end up engaging with enemy aircraft?
The MiGs were more after we'd finished in 67. We just had the AK-AK and the SAM missiles, and then they started getting more MiGs in there, finding a place that we didn't dare hit their airports for some reason. So they had a place to operate their MiGs from. It was more from the after 1960, mid-67 till the end, mm-hmm. that the MiGs were more of a pain.
How do you know what to do if you get a MiG on your tail?
Well, you drop your own bombs, clean your wing off, and the F-105 could outrun a MiG. If you were going downwind, you could go in afterburner and still, even with a load of bombs on, you could outrun the MiG. As long as they were going the other direction and they had to turn around, they would never catch you.
Again, if any of these questions are dumb or seem goofy, forgive me, but being over there as long as you were, flying 71 missions, and you see these other guys get shot down, I'm just wondering if you had mentally prepared yourself for the possibility of being shot down, of being a prisoner of war, or worse.
Oh, yeah, you had to be prepared. It was just one of the things you had to accept. There was always a possibility that you might not make it back for this mission. But we never had anybody abort because of it.
I guess maybe that's what I'm getting at. And you would know better than anybody because, you know, you flew those 71 missions and you flew with a bunch of other guys. Guys who survived close calls, guys who got shot down, who had to live for years as POWs. What did it require? What kind of courage did it require to be one of those F-105 pilots in that squadron?
You just had to be a 105 pilot. That was what we were trained to do. You had to accept it. I don't remember ever thinking about it. We have one guy that every time we were briefing for a mission, he would hit his head and go his pants. Really. I mean, he'd spend half the time on the pot, and he'd come back in, and he'd finish the briefing. He'd go do it again. But once he got him in the air, he could do it.
Of all the aircraft that you got to fly, is there one that you appreciated the most?
Well, the F-105 for a fighter, yes. It's the one I flew the most of, and the one I flew combat in. The other one was the F-100. I enjoyed that. The F-86 was just a training airplane for me. Stateside, no combat.
Was it a tough decision for you whether to stay in the Air Force or not after 21 years?
No, I was 35 years old when I retired from the Air Force. That was the last year hiring for an airline, so that's the reason I went ahead and I was at Waco, Texas, and I applied for World Airways, got accepted, so I went ahead and retired. Because they were moving from Waco down to Austin, and because I just been promoted to major because I had 8 years enlisted time, you know, and so I had 12 years commission. It worked out fine, and I didn't have to stay my extra year because of the move, and so I managed to retire at age 35 years, 6 months, and 26 days.
And I don't think there are too many people that can tell us that they served more than 20 years in the Air Force and retired at age 35.
That's probably true.
Can you imagine a 15-year-old today going into the Air Force?
No, I can't. I can't. I really can't.
How do you think your Air Force experience contributed to your civilian career as a pilot?
Hour-wise, I didn't have that many. I only had about 6,000 hours of military time. And after 26 years with World, I ended up with 26,000 hours.
And didn't you enjoy that, flying for the airline?
Oh, yes. I enjoyed it. Yes. Coffee, please.
When's the last time you flew? You were in the cockpit.
1994. I turned 60 in 92, and that was the cutoff date. And because I was a check captain, I got to stay on for two more years. I probably could have stayed a little bit longer, but I would have retired.
And I'm just wondering, there may be some people listening that are thinking about a career in aviation. Maybe they even want to be fighter pilots like you were. I've got a nephew who's at the Air Force Academy right now, and that's what he's hoping to do. What kind of advice would you have for a young man or woman who wants to follow in your footsteps?
Just set your goals and get with it. If you're in the Air Force Academy right now, you've got it all laid out for you, really. But mine was such that I didn't have much choice. I managed to get my pilot's license before I even got into aviation. I had more hours in my little Super Cub than my instructor did in primary pilot training, you know. He was a F-80 pilot in the Korean War. My instructor when I went to the primary pilot training at Baton Rouge, Georgia, when he found out I already had my private pilot's license, you know, he said, "You got more hours in a damn airplane than I have," you know. So it was pretty good.
Everyone's story is unique, but if there's such a thing as more unique, I think yours is right up there. And I can tell you enjoy talking about the lighthearted moments and the fun memories and the things that made you laugh. But there's a serious side to the era in which you served too. And there's a wall in Washington, D.C. with 58,000 names on it. Are some of those names of guys that you knew?
Oh, yes. Not so much in the Korean War, but in the Vietnam War, yes.
Have you been there to the Vietnam Memorial?
Yes, I have. It's an experience to go around and look at the names. I know where to look for them, you know, because of the area or the years. And quite a few of them are there.
Well, and if you're able to share, what goes through your mind? What do you think about when you see those names on that wall of guys that you knew and you served with?
Well, I miss them. I think of them. I prayed for them. And I thank them. That's all I can say.
And I guess that's, you know, because you have a perspective that so many of us wouldn't, because you did things that we didn't do. And clearly the implication is your name easily could have been on that wall too. But when you say you think about them, can you help us understand the significance of their sacrifice? Why it still matters all these years later?
What gets me is the people that did not appreciate the fact that we were defending our country. Any way you look at it, wherever we were fighting at, we were defending our country. And a lot of people don't understand it. Yeah. That's what makes me mad.
Understandably so. And I just realized I forgot to ask you about something I noticed in your shadow box of medals on the wall. Not far from that silver star there, I see some jump wings. What's the story there?
The 105, that each squadron had to have two jump qualified people to jump in with the Army for close air support. Mm-hmm. And so I volunteered to go to Fort Benning. I was running 4 miles in the morning, 4 miles in the afternoon. I had broken in my boots by soaking them in water and then leaving them on until they dried. So I went down there, and it was a good experience to go through the jump school down there, Fort Benning. I was 31 years old when I did this. The old sergeant that gave me the entrance exam, he ended up being one of our leaders. And so he said, "Number 407, that was my helmet number. Right guy." So I got up there, and I could run those 17, 18, 19-year-old kids so they'd all be vomiting. They go, "Number 407, right guy." "Oh, not that old man again." It was pretty good. I was in pretty good shape then.
Most pilots don't ever want to have to deploy a parachute. How did you take to the jumping off the towers or the actual jumping out of a plane?
We had to do 5 jumps out of the airplane, and we jumped off the tower a couple times. It was a good experience. I enjoyed it. I had dislocated my shoulder playing at the squadron officer school, and so my very first jump, I dislocated my shoulder. The old sergeant was right behind me. In fact, he walked across my chute. So I said, Sergeant, come here, grab my arm, pull it. And he could feel, you know, and it slipped back in position. And then I'd go ahead and butterfly my chute. And he said, "Let me get your chute for you." I know I can do it now. I had to do 4 more jumps, but I only dislocated my first jump. My wife I would roll over in bed and dislocate it. I'd wake her up. I'd say, honey, pull my arm, you know.
Well, if there's anything I didn't ask you about, you know, feel free to add it in. I do want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this unique story you have.
Well, I tell you what, I really enjoyed my service career, and I enjoyed my airline career. I enjoy it here. I love being with other service people. I really do. I really do.
You know, you mentioned that what you were doing at the time when you're flying in Vietnam and risking your life, that maybe it was not appreciated the way you wished it were. Maybe it was misunderstood. Yeah. And a lot of people alive today didn't live through that time period, and they don't have any firsthand perspective. So how would you explain your perspective on what you guys were doing over there and what those 58,000 names on the wall represent today?
Well, you have to realize that if you didn't do that, where would we be at today? I've voted for these people that wanted us to do that. They were up there giving us guidance. Mm-hmm. And so I've sworn to uphold the U.S. Constitution, so I'll do it. No problem.
91 years is a long time. When you think back over those 91 years, is there something that you would say that you are personally most proud of or most thankful for?
What am I most proud of? I got three beautiful children. My wife was a nurse, an Air Force nurse. She was a wonderful lady. I only knew her 19 days before we got married.
How'd you pull off getting her to marry you in 19 days?
We were going up to her aunt and uncle. They lived up in Stigler, Oklahoma. I met her in Wichita Falls, Texas. I met her at the officers' club. A good friend of mine introduced me to her. I taught her how to play liar's dice the first night, sitting at the bar. I had to buy her three drinks. I said, well, let's roll for dinner at Lister's Hickory Inn. And damn if I didn't have to buy her a $3.40 steak dinner. She lived in the nurses' quarters, and I was in the bachelor officers' quarters, so we didn't have any other place to go, so... She says, I'm going to go up there and see my aunt and uncle this weekend. So I said, what time are you going to leave? She says, oh, sometime Friday afternoon. And I got to be back here Monday morning to go to work. I said, well, I'll be free. So I rode, she drove and I rode up there. Her aunt and uncle were just beautiful, really a beautiful couple. And we had a great time. He says, why don't you two come back next weekend? She says, yeah, I can do that. So I drove the next weekend. We got up there on Friday afternoon. We drove up to Tulsa and went to a big dance. Came back to their house, and her uncle looked over at me, and he says, you know, you two were made for each other. Why don't you two get married? He made arrangements for the judge to come to their house on Sunday, and we got married. And we had over 65 years together. So what was your question again?
I think you answered it. I said, what are you most proud of? And those sound like some pretty good answers.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Well, thanks to Bob McCoy and to his neighbors at Paradise Valley Estates in Fairfield, Kevin and Bee Olson, for introducing him to us. I hope you can join us next time when we learn about a new book that includes a riveting prisoner of war story you heard firsthand on this program more than a decade ago. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.